They're the direct victims of violence, those that can be extorted, kidnapped, or even suffer homicides. But there are also indirect victims of violence. If you're afraid of going to work, this is going to affect your economic outcomes. This is going to affect your economic well-being.
Welcome to Vox Dev Talks. My name is Tim Phillips. What's the economic impact of persistent violent crime on a community? Are people scared to go to work, or do more people in a household need to work? Do firms shut their doors, or do they flourish when criminals splash the cash? Data from Mexico gives us fresh answers to these questions. Andrea Velasquez of the University of Colorado Denver did the analysis, and she joins me now. Welcome, Andrea.
Hi, Tim, and thank you for inviting me to talk about my research on crime in Mexico.
You're very welcome. Now, tell me first of all about the rise in violence in Mexico driven by the drug war that I think is the focus of this research.
If we observe the trend of homicides in Mexico in the last 20 years, homicide rates had been pretty stable in the early 2000s. However, starting in 2008, what we see is this dramatic and rapid increase in homicides. And just to give you an example of the magnitude of this spike, homicide rates more than tripled between 2008 and 2010. This was a rapid increase in violence, and more than 10 years later, the level of homicides has not returned to those observed in the mid-2000s. Now, the cause of this rapid increase in violence has been widely studied. And one strand of the literature explains that this spike of violence was a byproduct of the military strategy that was taking place when Felipe Calderón became president in 2006. He declared a war on drugs. And the military strategy was one of like pure confrontation against these cartels or organized crime groups. One of the main military strategies was to go after the main leaders or the capos of these cartels. And this destabilized the old oligopolistic equilibrium of violence where these cartels operated, maintaining relatively low levels of violence. So Eduardo Guerrero Gutierrez is one of the expert voices on organized crime in Mexico. And what he explains is that by going after the main leader of a drug trafficking group, there are two types of violence that are going to emerge. And the first one is going to be an internal conflict within these cartels because they are going to go after the leadership within this organization. And the other one is going to be an increase of confrontations between enemy organizations that are going to fight for territorial control. This is actually what explains both this temporal variation, so this rapid increase in violence, but importantly, this also explains the geographic dispersion of violence in Mexico. And this is key because now you are going to have municipalities that didn't have any presence of cartels before, any drug-related violence, that see this rapid increase in violence. And just to give you another sense of the magnitude of this increase, the number of cartels also multiplied in this period. In 2006, there were six cartels that were operating in what people have called this oligopolistic equilibrium. And by 2011, there were 16 cartels. This also changed the dynamics of violence because now you have these cartels that are, this confrontation is also going to diversify their financial resources. And although still resources from drug trafficking are going to be the main financial resource, they're also going to rely on crime that are going to affect more directly the civil population, like kidnappings, extortions, and car thefts. In addition, what we see from the news of that time is that they are also going to rely on what we saw and what we call these narco messages. Like, for example, dead bodies that are left for the public to see with a clear message from the cartels with the purpose of spreading fear and that actually increase the fear among the community. And what I'm going to tell you is that fear has been an important mechanism explaining the effects of crime on labor outcomes.
You're using the recorded data on homicides to measure violent crime, but in such a chaotic, lawless situation, how accurate can this data be?
Yeah, that is a great question. So there are like two answers here. And the first one is that homicides has been used widely in the literature to measure crime and violence. And there are two reasons. And the first one is that in order to measure homicides, you don't rely on reporting like property crimes or personal injuries. So that is going to help in that sense. There's going to be less measurement error or misreporting because of it. And the second one is because the classification of a homicide is homogeneous across regional boundaries. So again, like less prone to measurement error. But what you're saying is, yeah, great, that works in normal conditions. But in this chaotic context, maybe things are changing and the ability or motivation to accurately report homicides or seeing the dead bodies is going to change. So that doesn't seem to be a problem in the context of Mexico. The saliency of the issue was so big that we have different sources of homicides. So we have academics, the national press, NGOs. They started to also report or measure homicide rates. And I have compared all these sources because just like you, I was very worried about that. And they are very similar. They're very consistent.
And what data do you have to match this with the economic effect on Mexican people?
So we have the homicide data. This comes from the statistics office, all publicly available. This is going to be available at the month level and municipality level. What I'm going to do is to match these with individual outcomes. These individual outcomes come from the Mexican Family Life Survey. Importantly, this is also publicly available. I'm going to refer to this as like MXFLS. So what is the MXFLS? This is a nationally longitudinal survey representative of the national population. That is important as well. How this data is collected? The first wave was collected in 2002. Okay, so this is going to be representative at the national level. Then since it is longitudinal, we are going to follow the same individuals in the following waves. So we follow the same individuals in 2005. So this is important because the data that I use is going to be second and third wave. Second wave happens in 2005, so during low levels of violence, right? And then third wave, the data is collected, most of it between 2009 and 2010, already when we see this high level of violence. So I'm going to have this longitudinal survey that I'm going to observe the same individual during low levels of violence, high levels of violence, that is nationally representative and has rich set of information.
This isn't the first time that studies like this have been attempted, is it, Andrea? And the previous research seems to have had fairly inconclusive results. So What makes you think that this data is going to give you a better insight?
Yeah, you're going to the challenge of answering this question, right? Yeah. In many cases, the location and timing of violence is not random or is not unanticipated. And the problem with that is that then individuals are going to either select into these places or select out of these places. So exposure to violence is going to be highly selected. So what I'm going to argue is that this research is going to make an advancement to the literature because of two important conditions. The first is that I'm going to argue, and I'm going to convince you by the end of this talk, that this increase of violence can be considered as exogenous. It was really unexpected. And one of the key issues is that Felipe Calderón, in his speech to become president, never talked about this war on drugs. It was not one of the things that he was talking about. So this was unexpected. And the second one that is important here is that the timing of the survey, this was kind of lucky. Because I was telling you, look, now consider that we have this quasi-random variation in violence. This was unexpected, not related to other characteristics, and I test that. And now I'm going to have this information, longitudinal information, that allows me to observe the outcomes of this same individual during low levels of violence and high levels of violence. So at the individual level, I'm going to be able to say, look at this effect of crime that is exogenous, and I'm going to look at this individual change on labor outcomes. Since I have the same individual, I'm going to be able to control for all individual characteristics, including unobserved characteristics that are time invariant. For example, fixed ability. Right? Ability could be related with exposure to violence and labor outcomes. I can control for that. And I test that actually controlling for this is important in these settings. The other important thing too is that since it is a longitudinal survey, we made a lot of effort to follow everybody. And this was hard in this setting, and particularly with the high levels of violence. But even if you migrated out of your original community, we were going to follow you. So we can directly test whether migration is a behavioral response to violence. And lastly, the MXFLS is a very rich survey. It has a lot of information on labor outcomes. So I'm going to be able to look not only at whether you participate or not, but how many hours you're working, what is your occupation, are you changing occupations? And I have such a rich set of characteristics that I can also explore potential mechanisms that explain why violence is affecting these outcomes.
Are you catching all types of labor income? Because I seem to remember that Mexico has a pretty large informal sector. It has a lot of self-employment. Are you catching those earnings as well?
Yes. And that is super important because a lot of times when you have data from like industry, from the firms, you have only formal work or work from like wage workers. This is going to be self-reported, but since it is self-reported from the individual, we are going to be able to characterize if they are wage workers, self-employed, if they work in the formal or informal sector. And Tim, this is very important what you're saying because qualitative evidence has shown that business owners were particularly affected because of these extortions. And even nowadays, they still talk about how they still need to pay like what they call a cuna. That is, every month they need to pay something so they are able to operate. So it was super important to be able to analyze this heterogeneity.
Right, so you're catching the non-random nature of homicides, migration, the informal economy and self-employment. So what is the effect on participation in the labor force of violence?
Before going to the details of the results, it is important to tell you again and to remind you that one of the limitations of the data is that the last wave was collected in 2010. Mm-hmm. And let's remember that what I'm going to capture is like, okay, the change of violence between 2005 and 2010, but the spike of crime started by like 2008 or so. So these can be considered like short-term effects. This caveat is important to have in mind. Now, when I started to think about, okay, what is the effect on labor outcomes? I really thought about what we were talking before, that is, I don't think that the effects were going to be homogeneous for wage workers and self-employed individuals. And again, because everything that you were reading at the time is that business were closing, there were extortions. So that is a first level of heterogeneity that I wanted to explore. And not only because of this qualitative evidence, you can also think from a theoretical point of view that if there is violence, you want to react to it or you are afraid, you might react to it more easily if you are flexible, right? If you can say, okay, today I close my business or I stop working. But if you're a wage worker and you have a contract, you might have an effect, but it might be delayed. And that is exactly what I find. I find overall no effects for wage workers. And again, I want to repeat, these are all short-term effects. Everything is driven by self-employed workers, as like intuitively you would have thought to begin with. Within self-employment, there is still a lot of heterogeneity. And the heterogeneity that I'm going to exploit is by gender. And again, this was driven by intuition. And you can think again that in a society like Mexico, the reaction to these shocks is going to be different by gender. And why is that? Because this is a context where most of the main breadwinners are males. Females overall are less attached to the labor force. We find that when there is this shock, this was surprising for me, but there's no effect on either intensive or extensive margin of participation of males. They are still going to work. And I think this is driven by the fact that they are the main breadwinners. They still need to go to work. But females are the ones that are going to cut their labor force. And interestingly, this is driven by women that have characteristics that could explain that they are less attached to the labor force. Like overall, they are less educated. They are married. If there is like some negotiation within the household, maybe they are the ones that need to cut their working hours. And what happens, and this is interesting, there is a substitution of time allocation. They stop working outside and they spend more time on domestic chores and helping kids with their homeworks. I have thought about these results so much right now with COVID, and that is exactly what we see. And this is super important to have in mind because what we see is that these shocks are affecting in an unequal way males and women. An equal society like Mexico and many Latin American countries, this can have important long-term consequences on labor outcomes of women, as we are seeing right now with COVID.
But we already know, don't we, Andrea, that this drug war has been a disaster for Mexican people. So is there a policy implication from this? Because it's not like we've suddenly discovered that there are adverse effects.
Absolutely. I think sometimes when I say like, oh yeah, there is a negative effect, then people can say, yeah, but we knew. So what is new about this? First, when we think about policy making that is going to design programs to alleviate the effect of violence, we need to think that there are two different types of victims. There are the direct victims of violence, those that can be extorted, kidnapped, or even suffer homicides. But there are also indirect victims of violence. And the thing, what this is telling us is that the main driving mechanism is fear. Mm-hmm. And what this tells you is that if you're afraid of going to work, this is going to affect your economic outcomes. This is going to affect your economic well-being. And the government, or when we think about policymaking, then it needs to think about how am I going to offer the conditions that make these individuals feel safe to go to work. And the problem in a context like Mexico is that there was not only this fear of being victimized by cartels, but also lack of trust in the police and in the institutions of the state. So this is something that needs to improve. So we need to think about, like, how are you going to provide those safety measures so people think that they are safe going out to work? Mm-hmm. And the second one is that these problems are, like, very complex. And what this shows you is that one policy is not going to work for everybody. So you need to understand that, for example, fear affected labor force participation of women. But fear didn't affect labor force participation of males. Males were actually affected because their earnings went down. Their labor force participation didn't change, but their earnings suffered. And this was not because of their fear, but because overall labor demand went down. Food traffic went down and the demand of their services went down. So when we think about these policies, we need to think about the complexity of these issues. And in addition, I have worked so much on this topic, we find that there's not only an effect on labor outcomes, there's also an effect on human capital accumulation. There is an effect, for example, in risk preferences. People mm-hmm. become more afraid and more risk averse, and this can have an effect on the type of investments, savings, migration decisions. So we need to think about this complexity and how to offer the safe environment for individuals. And again, like going to preferences, think about the psychological effect that violence can have on individuals.
Very significant research. Thank you very much for talking about it with me, Andrea.
Thank you, Tim. It is a pleasure to talk about this.
If you want to read more about this, I imagine you probably do. The paper is called The Economic Burden of Crime, Evidence from Mexico. And there is just one author you've just heard from her, Andrea Velasquez. This has been a Vox Dev Talk. The best way to make sure you don't miss an episode is to subscribe on your podcast platform. And our past episodes, as ever, are at voxdev.org.